But here's the problem when we look at any type of industry. You can come in and do the industry. You will benefit the local community for that time being. But in the long run, are you benefiting the community for future generations?
All right, everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Space Tomatoes podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Havoc. We've got LX with us as well, and today we have a special guest, Andrew Lewin, a marine biologist and the host of How to Protect the Ocean, a podcast that explores the people, science, and policies driving ocean conservation. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Oh, thanks, guys. I'm super excited to be here today.
Awesome. Awesome. So what do you, I think you actually have two channels, right? You have another one on.
I do. So I have two podcasts. I have How to Protect the Ocean, which is literally what it says. It's how to teach people how to protect the ocean. And I have another podcast that I co-host with another biologist named David Ebert. He is known as the Lost Shark Guy. So we call that podcast Beyond Jaws. And we talk about sharks beyond sort of the iconic sharks that we normally talk about, the great white shark, tiger sharks, makos, and thresher sharks. We talk about little sharks. He's discovered and described over 50 species of sharks in his life, and it's pretty cool. And we talk to different people about their shark career, shark science, and conservation career, so that, you know, people who want to get into it, you know, who are just graduating and want to, and even in high school, want to learn more about sharks and they want to research sharks as they get older. We kind of give them advice by through interviews and looking at people's career trajectories and knowing that, you know what, it's not that easy, but it's also a meandering path, right? As all careers tend to be, it's not like a straightforward career. So you can go in and out. And so we talk to people who have been in the business for like 35 years. Some have been in 10 years. Some have been in, like, you know, 5 years, and they all have a different way of getting into it. And they all do some pretty cool stuff over that lifetime. So it's kind of fun to kind of give people a perspective of what's going in. But my flagship show is the How to Protect the Ocean podcast. I started it. I'm a marine biologist that lives in Ontario, Canada. And so it's a little hard to do marine biology when you're not surrounded by oceans. I'm surrounded by the Great Lakes, which empties into oceans. And we call it our Sweetwater Ocean here. We share it with the U.S. And we, you know, it's a lovely place to live, but it's difficult to do marine work. So I started podcasting and doing communications. So really started off with blogs, then went to YouTube. And then I discovered podcasting through a friend. And once I started recording, that was it. Like, I found my niche. I found, like, my passion. I was like, I always fell in love with the storytelling aspect of marine biology and ocean conservation. And I remember being, you know, on ships in the Gulf of Mexico and just kind of like looking around and being surrounded by all these cool scientists who are telling the stories of when they're, you know, some adversity they had to face, like in big waves, or, you know, when instruments wouldn't work and they had to gerrymander it as they go through. And it was always fun for me. And the research was fun as well. And doing all the analytics and all the science stuff was fun too. But the storytelling was probably my favorite aspect of it. And I get really passionate when I do that. So once I started the podcast, I started recording in 2014, and I published in finally in 2015, and I've been doing it ever since. So I just did 10 years in June was my 10-year anniversary for podcasting. So nice. Tons of fun. I love it. As you guys know, podcasting is so much fun.
It certainly is. Alex loved it. I know that he started before I did.
Oh yeah,
audio only, and that podcast was around an online mobile game. And,
nice.
Yeah, and so we actually met through an online mobile game. Very interesting story about a group of people from all over the U.S. coming together to meet people they only met in a game online. But
that is so cool.
So did you like grow up thinking, this is what I want to do?
Ever since I was 14. You know, I always loved, you know, I was born in 78. So I grew up on Jacques Cousteau documentaries, watching Jaws, watching all these different movies and documentaries on the ocean. And as soon as I saw it, I fell in love with it. And then I found out you can have a career on it. And I was like, all right, cool. Like, this is what I want to do. And throughout high school, I probably frustrated the heck out of my teachers because every time we had like a biology project, I didn't want to do it on the human body. I wanted to do it on, you know, a dolphin or a shark or a whale or a penguin or something different because that's what motivated me. And I was very fortunate to have some great teachers in high school who allowed me to have that leeway to do that and expand my mind. And then I went to university here in just a town just not far from me at Guelph and did a marine biology and freshwater degree. And it kind of just catapulted through there where I was just like, this is like, it's so much fun to be out in the field, you know, when you're on the ocean and to experience the different type of life you have on the ocean. You're seeing sunsets and sunrises, which are like out of this world. You're seeing, you know, dolphins bow riding your ship as you move along every single time. It seems like you don't see the dolphins when you're stagnant, but then as soon as you go, they're like, okay, let's have some fun. And they're there. And just like the water, like the water spouts, like these water tornadoes that kind of come up out of nowhere that you see, and you know, they're far enough away, thank God, and you don't have to worry about them. But it's just a fun place to be, and you just never know what to expect. There's always an adventure to happen, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but it's just a fun place to be and to discover. And there's so much we don't know about the ocean still, and it's fun to discover that and see people discover it as well.
Absolutely. So I'm going to throw out an assumption there. You are probably certified for scuba.
I am certified for scuba. Yeah, that's one of the things I did throughout in university. I started scuba diving. And I mean, that definitely changes your life in terms of from a pleasurable experience, like just going out and as an activity to go wherever I have the chance, I try and go scuba diving. But however, in Canada, you actually can't scuba dive the way we're thinking of scuba diving for your job because of insurance. Insurance ruins everything, I find.
Oh, really?
You know, it's all liabilities because you're not protected. So here in Canada, if you want to dive, you have to have your commercial's diving license. So think about the old school way of diving with the big metal helmet and the tube that you breathe out of, and that gets like, you know, that gets given to you, like the leeway gets given to you from the top of the ship. So we have, you know, we have divers, like they'll have be like consultants or divers. Like for when I used to work for the federal government, we have divers in Environment Canada and Climate Change Department who that's their sole purpose is to go out diving and deploy instruments and gather instruments and do all these different types of surveys and videos and all that kind of stuff. But they do it the old school way. And I guess they're more protected that way, which I totally completely understand. It's also colder here, so it can be difficult. But what it does make is makes it super expensive. So it's very difficult to, get a lot of stuff done when you're trying to do that type of work when you can't go scuba diving traditionally. I think in the U.S. you can. I know like academically you can. It all depends on the insurance of the company or the organization that allows you to do it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the way we get around that here is through grants, right? Instead of actually doing the research and fund it, you offer a grant to someone else, they can take the liability.
Exactly.
We get the data. I actually got certified for scuba when I was 13 years old. Basic scuba certification through NAWI.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And NAWI is, to date, I think they are still the most intense certification course you can go through.
I've heard that.
Back then, you know, we didn't have soft weights. We had lead. We didn't have like fancy, like our BCs were horse collars and there was no auto inflate. You took your regulator in your mouth, you put a little air into it. And the old US diver swim fins with absolutely zero flex in them.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, wetsuits measured in like inches, right? Quarter inch, half, you know, stuff like three quarter inch.
Oh, yeah.
And beaver tails, the worst thing ever invented for someone in the male portion of the population. There's a beaver tail on a wetsuit, I promise you.
Yeah, yeah, it's. I can imagine it is. I've never worn one, obviously, but I can imagine it's a bit of a pain in the butt to do, literally.
Yeah, it is. It is. But it was fun, and I guess I've been scuba diving for 43 years.
Oh, that's awesome.
Grew up in Orange County, California, for a good part of my life.
Nice.
And my whole thing was I wanted to go to, like, you know, potentially UCSB, Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great school.
And then I really wanted to end up at Scripps Institute.
Oh, yes.
That was my dream there.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I guess I was talked out of it, which in retrospect mm-hmm. was probably a good thing. Mm-hmm. Given where I ended up, but at the same time, the passion, you know, passion's always been there. So, you know, some really cool, things like, I got to witness the founding of the Surf Rider Foundation.
Oh, wow.
Which has done so much. I believe it was like in the late 70s, I believe, early 80s.
Yeah.
And then I've gotten to take part in pier cleanups and things like that, which is where they literally just put a call out to divers mm-hmm. and then they host little contests, right? The weirdest object you bring in, the most stuff, the heaviest object, all this stuff. And divers would just descend on public beaches and go around the piers and clip lines and hooks off the piers and, you know, pick up trash and everything mm-hmm. else. And just such an enormous impact. What do you think are some ways that are actionable for Joe Blow and Jane Blow to be able to do things that are impactful directly to this, but don't necessarily require them to fund something or make a trip?
Yeah, I mean that's the million-dollar question, right? Is you know the ocean is in trouble, you know, in many different ways. You know, scientists say it, we all say it, a lot of people know about it. You've probably seen a lot of campaigns that are out there, you know, in various times over the life, even these days. And so the idea is to inspire people enough to take action. Right. And I always tell people this, like we all, like when I started the podcast, one of the reasons why I started to just even communicate in general, start talking about science, because when I started, like even back in 2010, people weren't like scientists weren't really talking about science. You know, we weren't told to talk about science. We were actually told not to. It's not incentivized in our pay or in our jobs. We do it because we enjoy it. It's a passion, right? Like to be a marine biologist, it's something that it's not just a 9-to-5. You're always a marine biologist, even at home. So we talk about work all the time. We do work all the time. We work at night. We work during the day. It's all over the place. So we do enjoy talking about it. But back then, even further back, you know, there were a lot of journalists out there that were manipulating scientists' words as they were giving interviews, you know, and talking about their science to get the clicks and to get, you know, the advertisement and things like that, and make it a little bit more impactful. Because sometimes science is boring. Sometimes conservation is boring, and you just got to go and you got to do the work. So the trouble is trying to inspire, and that's what I wanted to do, because I realized that even my family and friends when I started doing communication. You know, somebody would come up and ask me, this was in 2010, and it was a cousin of my wife's, and she said, and they said, they were like, yeah, like, what is this climate change thing? Like, should we be worried about it? And I was like, yes, absolutely. Like, how do you not know this? Like, you know, in my head, I wasn't rude to the person because it was a genuine question, but I was like, in my head, I was like, how do we not know that climate change is a bad thing? Like for me as a scientist, like the data was there. I tell the data from my brain to your brain, facts are coming and that's what I'm doing. It just wasn't interesting. It wasn't interest, like being of interest to anybody. And when I started to look around, you know, the internet was really taking off at that point. Mm-hmm. Facebook had taken off. Twitter had taken off. It was changing in a very different way than we'd seen, you know, the past 10 years. And there was a lot of distraction in our lives. You know, you know, people were worried about Hollywood. People were worried about the Kardashians and, you know, sports and all these different things that make up our lives, that entertain us and that, you know, make life a little easier to go through just instead of your job or parenting or whatever. And of course, those are distractions in itself. And then here we are with this planet that we have And so many things are happening to it. And, you know, we're not really paying attention to it. It's a difficult thing because the way we were telling people was, this is bad. This is bad. This is going bad. What you're doing is wrong. What you're doing is wrong. What the government's doing wrong and everything like that. It was all doom and gloom. And so I quickly realized that, you know, I can't just like, we can't as like a conservation field, can't just talk to people in a way where it's like, we're doing bad stuff. Because we're all caught up into this the same system. You know, we're all in a wasteful system. You know, we see it all the time. We have, you know, single-use plastics. We have all this stuff that we see. And you know, divers and surfers, you know, kayakers, anybody who's around the ocean knows that there's a lot of trash, that there's a lot of pollution. And sometimes it prevents you from going in the water. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it can be... That could inspire people, but it can also detract people from going to the beach or just enjoying the water in general. And so like, and then of course in our lives now, especially these days when you have like these phones and you have all this technology, you see people getting disconnected from nature. We're not paying attention to what's around us. You know, we're in our phones or we're in our cars getting to work or we're doing whatever that might be. We're very disconnected from the world, from the natural world. And so like the first thing that I tell people is like literally touch grass or touch water. Like just enjoy nature. Enjoy the peace. Enjoy the calm. I did this, speaking of Scripps Institute, I did this episode 1 year. It was during Oceans Day. I published it on Ocean Day. And it was a student that came to me from Scripps. She was a master's student. And she did this music composition. She was a musician and she did this, well, not really a music composition, but a composition of noise. And it was basically an audio version of someone going from their home in this was, it was supposed to be like Southern California, because that's where she was, from their home in Southern California to their car and to the beach. And all the noises you encounter throughout that time. So think about, you know, you're going out your house saying bye to your family, whatever, there's noise of the kids and everything like that, which is good noise because, you know, it's your family and stuff like that. The noise of the door opening, you locking the door with the key. Now, I know a lot of us don't have keys, but, you know, with the key. And then you're walking out, you get into a car, maybe you hear a helicopter or a siren that's nearby. You get into your car, you put the radio on, you're listening to music or you're listening to like a morning show or something like that. And then you start getting all the traffic and all the city noise and you get down. And as you get closer and closer to nature, to the beach, it starts to get quieter and quieter and quieter. And then you're starting to hear the birds and then you're starting to hear the wind and the trees rustle around. And then you start to hear just you walking on the beach, which got that like your feet in the sand type of noise, right? Stuff you don't realize that's actually noise that's calming you down. Like all that anxiety that we hold from our life going from one place to the next and looking at our phones and always being stimulated by information. As you get into nature, you're calming yourself. Even the color blue of the water calms you down. It's known by neurologists to calm you down. And so you get into the water, you got your dive stuff on, you're putting your dive stuff on, you get into the water and all of a sudden you start to hear all the noises around you from underwater. And it's not just whales and seals and dolphins and clicks and sounds like that, but it's also like the reef, we realize, makes sounds. Fish make sounds, you know, crabs will make sounds, like all these different, like you have a pistol shrimp every once in a while, they'll sound like a, you know, a gun going off every once in a while. And then you start to, you know, so you start to hear that calmness and then it's just like nature and you just feel so good. And it really changed the way I thought about conservation. And it's really just to tell people every once in a while, just slow down. And touch grass or touch water, touch something in nature and just ponder and just think, you know, because we don't do that as much as we used to, you know, when we were kids, right? Like I grew up, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have phones. We didn't have anything like that. That wasn't readily available. And there was actually a comedian I saw a clip of, and I forget the guy's name, but it was really interesting. He was very crass about this, but he's like, you know, right now the word mindfulness is a huge word right now. You know, we all need to be mindful. We all need to take some time and meditate, take some time to be mindful. Well, this comedian was like, well, back when we were kids, like in the 80s and 90s, Well, we everything was mindful. You know, you're waiting for your friend. That's mindfulness. You're sitting there thinking of life and everything. You're on the bus. Mindfulness. You know, like all these different things. You're in the bathroom. Mindfulness. Maybe you're reading a magazine. Maybe you're not. I don't know. But you're not on your phone scrolling for the next piece of news or you know, funny videos of people like falling or, you know, kittens falling off a table or something like that. And so it really, like, I know this is a long answer, but really it's just to inspire people to just go back to nature and enjoy. Just relax a little bit. You know, I think that's the biggest, it's the first step. And then just feel it out from there. You know, I don't expect people to change their entire lives to protect the ocean. I would like it, you know, but really it's how can we? We're so busy with everything we do. So what I ask people to do is just think about the ocean, right? Like live for a better ocean wherever and whenever you can, you know? So like there's some easy things you can do to change just sort of your natural behaviors. Single use plastic, you can change that. You know, it might be a little bit, you know, tough at the beginning because it's a habit that you have to change, but like we don't need plastic bags anymore. You know, we have reusable bags. You don't need to buy a bunch of like 70 reusable bags. You just need a few. Keep them in your car. You know, things like that. It's all these different things that you can do and look around your house and do like an audit and be like, what can I do easily? You know, like I remember when we were changing incandescent light bulbs to LEDs. You know, that was a big thing. People didn't like how LEDs were brighter, so they made them more like incandescent, but they last longer and they're cheaper. And they were more expensive, but they lasted longer. We slowly started to change them in our house as we went through. Like, it doesn't have to be quick, you know, but the more you change, the better it is. And the more people who change, the better it'll be in the long run. So it's just these little changes that we can do. Yes, we have to move fast, but it's not always up to you and I to do it. Like, it's the three of us can't change the world just because we decide, you know, to stop with single use plastics, right?
Right.
We need government to really enact huge policies, and that's on them. And it's on us to, you know, vote for the people who are in that position to do those different policies and not just cater to the companies who like pay for their campaigns to get them there. You know, so it's like it's a push and pull kind of system. You know what I mean?
Indeed. I will say my personal views on some of that are a little different, and that's okay.
Yeah.
We all have our own personal things.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that I always like to throw out there is this, and this was something I think the Surf Rider Foundation really hit home, at least for us in you know, Southern California. They went around and did something and people are like, well, why are you doing this? And what it is just a simple stencil. They went around and they stenciled all the storm drains, a little logo that says drains to ocean.
Yeah.
And you'd be amazed at how many people don't realize that. Those stormwater drains drain directly to the ocean. They're not like going to some sewage containment location or anything like that. It's literally just a canal that goes to a bigger canal that goes to a bigger canal that dumps out into the ocean. So, you know, one of the simple things I think is if you're out and about, man, you see litter, grab it, throw it away, throw it in a bag, throw it in a backpack, whatever you got. If you're down at the ocean, when you leave, take one extra piece of trash with you. Just one. I mean, that's inconsequential, but it'll make a huge difference. And I mean, if you're interested in looking at why this would be a big thing, go look at some of the photos from the hauls from the pier cleanups. You would be amazed at how much garbage is under there. They don't let divers that aren't at least advanced rated go to these events a lot of the times because of the danger of the junk and the lines and the hooks and everything else under these piers, not to mention wave action with the piers.
Well, piers piers in general could be a tough dive if you don't know what you're doing, right? And you don't have experience. Imagine trying to pick up, you know, fishing line from there and getting tangled in it. Or, you know, like you said before, there's some heavy objects that are in there that you're trying to do. Maybe you and another and your dive buddy trying to pick it up. It could be pretty scary in there. So, completely.
Using a lift bag and things like that is also something.
Yeah.
If you aren't certified at advanced level, you should not even have a lift bag. Okay. Yeah. You're a danger to others at this point.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think you hit the nail on the head with this, where it's, you know, we all share this planet. You know, it doesn't matter what country you're from. It doesn't matter what community you're from, what county, what state. It doesn't matter. We share this planet. And it's really our responsibility to take care of it. And it's not a finger pointing where you're not taking care of it, so I hate you. It's a, okay, cool, like there's some trash here. I don't want to see this on my beach or the beach that I decided to go on. So I'm going to pick it up. Now, of course, you do have to be careful because there's some pretty nasty trash out there that could be harmful to you. So maybe like some people will, I know people who have like, they do it so much that they'll just grab their latex gloves or something just to protect themselves. And they'll go out and they'll clean up a beach for like maybe a half hour while they're out there, either when they get there or after they leave, just to make sure that they left it a little bit better than it, what it was before. And I just think that's what it is. And you mentioned sort of the storm drains. It's you know, sometimes it's just basic knowledge, you know, where people are just not aware, and that's fine. Again, it's no judgment. It's you put a stencil that this is going right to the ocean. So if somebody's going to throw their cigarette butt down there, they might just think twice about doing it because, oh, actually, no, I don't want that to go to the ocean, you know. Yeah. And I think that's what it is. To me, it's, you know, the podcast that I do, you know, I deal sometimes with politics in terms of like how people are approaching certain policies, but the goal is not to judge anybody for whatever their beliefs are or for whatever they do or for wherever they come from. The idea is just being like, let's educate for the people who want this information. And then that, do what you want with it. And hopefully every episode I can get one person to be like, oh, actually, yeah, no, I'll stop using that for now. Or I'll just change my behavior. Cause you know, it's early January. I'm trying to lose weight. We know changing behaviors is not easy. You know, coming home and having that piece of chocolate after work is a cool thing to have. It makes me feel good. That's a hard habit to change. And so it's just like that, just like eating, the same thing with changing your behaviors around the ocean or what we're used to having, you know, is a big thing. I always tell my kids, I'm like, they drink at Starbucks. And I look at what you're drinking out of. You know, we bought you a reusable cup, like that Starbucks that has the label.
I might go a step further and say, do you know what you're putting in your body?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. The funny thing is usually when you try and do something environmentally responsible, it's usually good for you. Like nine times out of 10, it's good for you and your wallet. You know, I think that's the funny thing that it is. And there's other people who are trying to combat that, where it's like, no, you don't have to do it or this and that. And you're like, no, it's actually good for you to do it. You know,
it is.
So yeah, it's interesting.
Minimizing your use of plastics in general is a good idea for your own bodily health and for that of the planet.
Absolutely. You know,
one of the things that's interesting to me, it just popped in my head and all around this, is the unintended consequences. Right. I'll use Maryland. I'm sure you're familiar with the Bay, right?
Yes.
And was it 30 years ago or so? The blue crab industry was basically halted in Maryland for quite some time. It wasn't like trash in the ocean. It wasn't anything like that. It was farmers way upstream in Pennsylvania who didn't know better. Right. They just, and no offense to the Amish folks, but a lot of it was them. They didn't know better. Right. They just, you know, they don't have, you know, they live differently. Right. They don't have as open access to news and information as we do. And no judgment there. I think they live a wonderful life for them. And that's an awesome thing. But, you know, this is an unintended consequence of this farming, that actually the manure from cows, as well as pesticides and fertilizers and all this sort of stuff, got into the waterways, right? And so it doesn't have to be a beach. Every time you're by a waterway, remember, 100%. Every single waterway, with a few exceptions, like Salt Lake and, you know, very few exceptions, the Dead Sea, drains to the ocean. Mm-hmm. All of them. Eventually, you go far enough, it drains to the ocean, right? A lake in, you know, the mountains in Colorado
Yep.
That goes to the ocean.
That goes, yeah.
And it's you know, it's one of those things. If you just keep that in your mind, just pick up a piece of trash when you're near a waterway, or better yet, just do it in general. If you're out for a day, grab a piece of trash. Just one. You're not, you know, that's all. Just one little piece of trash, whatever it is, a plastic bottle, a can, whatever.
Doesn't matter. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I have two dogs. I'm in a neighborhood. We have a lot of dogs. And as I walk the dog, I will bring a bag and I will pick up the trash in the bag and put it in a bag. Just bring it back. Try and put it in recycling if it's recyclable, just to get it out. It's a little bit of just taking ownership of the neighborhood, right? Like I want my neighborhood to look good. I don't want trash. I know sometimes like there's nothing worse. Like I live in a place where it gets windy, you know? And so when you put trash out on a windy day, it's never a good sign. And so I'm out trying to pick up my trash that's blown down the street a little bit. And you see like neighborhoods who do that when you start doing it, other people start doing it and they look and they're like, oh, that's a good idea. Like it doesn't take much to do it. And it inspires you, makes you feel good for doing it as well. And I think that helps. It helps all of us, you know, when we look at the grandiose picture of protecting our planet and the ocean.
Absolutely. You're awful quiet there, Mr. LX.
I'm just taking it all in. So, I do get a question for you.
Yeah.
Knowing what you know, is there any kind of fish that you would eat from like Costco or Sam's Club or the supermarket, or is that no good? Any opinions on that?
I do. I absolutely do. And I think that's a very good question. You know, Costco, I don't know about Sam's Club. I know Costco for sure has a lot of fish that are what we call MSC certified. It's the Marine Stewardship Council certification. Now, there are a number of different certification programs out there for seafood. The idea is that each certification program provides transparency within the fishery, right? So the big thing is like back in the day when we were on coastal communities and we used to fish, you could go down to the dock and buy it right from the fisherman who bought it, who caught the fish. So you know exactly how it was caught, who caught it, because you know fishermen are going to talk about how they caught the fish, right? They love their fish stories. And you know that like they're not taking too much. And they like knowing that people are enjoying what they caught. These days, there's a lot of middle people within the supply chain. And so from the catch to the final area, like a supermarket or like a fish market or like a Costco or something like that, there are a lot of people who have their hands on the fish, which one, increases the price, but also puts up a lot of, I guess, cloudiness around what happens to that fish. Right. Mm-hmm. So having something like the Marine Stewardship Council or having the Monterey Bay, I think it's called Seafood Watch program, allows you to look at an app and says, like, especially the Monterey Bay Seafood Watch program, you can look at an app and you can basically look at any fish that you see in a supermarket and say whether it's good or you need to avoid or you should be cautious. And it's all on where it's caught, how it's caught, and what you should do about it. Right. And that really allows it empowers the consumer to make decisions based on what's in front of them. Now, here's the problem with that is that when you're asking the teenage kid who's serving you on across the counter at a grocery store or a supermarket, they may not know where it comes from, nor do they care. They're just there to have a job, you know, and I don't blame them. But it's very difficult. So a lot of times when I go there, I'll ask like, okay, there's a sea bass here. Like, how was that caught? Where was it caught? You know, I have an app here that tells me that I should be avoiding certain ones. And if they say, I don't know, I'll be like, well, I can't buy it because you don't know, unless you know someone who can tell me right now. But I'm not going to buy it because I don't know where that comes from. And I want to know, so I'm not contributing to the problem. That happens a lot. At restaurants, that happens. Now, you'll know the really nice restaurants, the chef will know because it's part of their entire plan. Right. They'll match the food to the wine, to the champagne, to whatever it is. You'll see that happen. But like, you know, your regular family restaurants that we take our kids to and stuff like that, they don't know. And so that I always tell them, like, yeah, well, because of that, I don't know. You know, I won't buy it because you don't know. Nothing against you, but, you know, it's good that you should know. And maybe that'll help them next time, you know, learn something and tell the customer what it is once they find out. But yeah, so what I would do is if you're interested in only buying sustainable seafood, download the Seafood Watch app. It's probably one of the most comprehensive seafood apps they do. They have full-time staff looking at the fisheries from all over the world. They have partners from all over the world making sure that it's sustainable. MSC certified Marine Stewardship Council is like a blue label. You'll see it at Costco. Those, I would trust those as well. They're not perfect by any means, but they are better than having nothing. And you know that you're on a better path to do that. And you support organizations like that by buying those fish. They don't get money for it, but it allows, it builds up their credibility and stuff. And there are people who hold their feet to the fire to make sure that they follow the right path and they acknowledge if something's not right and not perfect and stuff like that. So it's good that you mentioned that because, you know, that a lot of people, we don't realize it. We just see what's on the menu and we buy it. You know, local is always best, right? So whatever's local to you is always best. And with that said, some of the solutions have come, especially since COVID, because when COVID happened, a lot of the restaurants shut down, a lot of local fisheries shut down too. And so they couldn't sell anything. And so what some marketing agencies did, one in the UK, which was great in the Cornwall coastal town that had they fished, they had 40 different types of fish that they could fish, but nobody in the UK would eat these fish. They would import their fish from outside of the country. So they'd have like cod and haddock and stuff like that, but that wasn't their local food. And so when COVID hit and their fisheries got shut down and everything got shut down, this marketing company worked with these fisheries and say, hey, you know what? Let's just start a Facebook page and let's just put out like, hey, we have, you know, Joe Blow here from Cornwall and his family, they go out and they buy fish. If you tell them what you want, they'll go out and they'll catch it for you and then we'll deliver it to your door. And so they started to have this delivery service. What that was doing was not only at connecting the consumer back with the fisher, but it was helping these communities stay, paid, these fishing communities stay paid and be able to last in a very challenging time when everything was kind of going very chaotic for people and people were losing money, their homes and everything like that. And so that's kind of caught on and there's places like I know in Alaska, you can support, fisheries like that where you would get like, so it wouldn't be one specific fish or you order, it's like a catch lease. You know, those types of things where you'd put in like $200 for the season and then you'd get a box of seafood. If you don't mind randomized seafood, you would get randomized seafood. You can put them in your freezer and you can have them for the season. And then then you would get like a note or like a picture of the fisher and his family who's doing it. And hey, you know what? Actually, the fact that they go out and they know exactly what they need to catch, they save on gas, right? They save on diesel fuel, they save on equipment and they save on time. And they can come back to their families and they get paid. You pay a little bit more, but you know you're supporting somebody who's part of the community. Because a lot of these fishers, when they gave their stuff in, it would disappear. They wouldn't know where their stuff was going because the middle people would just take it and disperse it to wherever they want. Sorry, I cut you off. I apologize.
No. I have a habit of doing that. It wasn't you cutting me off at all. My sentence almost... the middle of your sentence almost interrupted the beginning of mine. Yeah. That's an interesting thought, right? Say, I know LX and I both, so I live on a small farm in North Carolina.
Nice.
And been here for eight and a half years now. Love it.
Okay.
Part of what we've done is localize our own food production much as possible. So we raise animals, but also grow a ton of vegetables, fruits, and berries.
Beautiful.
But what we also have done is we go to farmers markets for things where we don't necessarily raise them. Like our property can't support beef in the manner that we want to support it. In other words, I want to do regenerative agriculture, rotational grazing. Yes. I want to be a steward of the land, not just eat from it. And we don't have the property for that with the goats, the horses, the turkeys, the chickens, and the geese. But we also have a fish market here called Brothers Seafood that actually has people that they go down every morning to our local coast. It's about a 2-hour drive. And then they buy directly from the fishermen.
Yeah.
And they bring it back in. And one of the things that that allows them to do, and well, what you were talking about as well, is not overfish. Because mm-hmm. it may be popular to have, sea bass. It may be popular to have, you know, sea trout, right? But, you know, there's this thing where it becomes popular and then all the fishermen go and do it, but they don't have the customer base for it. And then it farms out and goes through that chain that you were talking mm-hmm. about, and who knows what happens there, right? So if you're putting in orders, the fishermen's being, you know, kept happy. They're reducing yep. their output costs, and they know when they've caught what they needed to bring back to fulfill all yeah. of their orders, rather than going, we got to keep catch while they're yep. while they're biting. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So that may be another huge sustainability factor.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it also, like, I think, you know, fishers have been vilified over the years, and there are some, you know, bad apples within the fishing industry. A lot of them tend to be in that industrial complex, huge commercial fishing sort of thing. The big trawlers that go out into the ocean and just are grabbing whatever they do. But for the most part, and most of the fishermen that I've met have been sort of small scale fisheries, you know, keep it to the town. You know, they might, some of their stuff might get exported to different provinces or states or wherever that might be. They don't want to overfish, you know, right. They want their kids to take over. You know, they enjoy being out. Like the funny thing about conservation is some of the best conservationists are fishers and hunters, you know, and some people find that an oxymoron, but I just think it's great because, like, look, I don't hunt. I don't know if you guys hunt, but I don't hunt. But when you're hunting, a lot of the times you are sitting in nature as quiet as can be, and you're just enjoying the view until you're, you know, your prey is coming by, you know, your deer or your moose or whatever that might be. And so I think a lot of these fishers and hunters get a bad rap when it comes to this. And it's like, look, like, and a lot of scientists and researchers are realizing this over the past like 20, 30 years and starting to act on it more over the past 10 and 20 of like partnering with these, with people like that are living off the land or off the sea and being like, look, you know more than us about this local area. You know what's biting, you know what's not. I mentioned David Ebert, the Lost Shark guy that I do the podcast with. He's found most of these sharks from fish markets around the world. You know, he'll go into towns in Africa and go into their local fish markets and talk to the fishers and be like, hey, this fish, when was the last time you saw it or before you caught it here? And he'll go, I've never seen this before, you know, mm-hmm. and I know these fish. I know this shark. I've never seen this before. Do you catch this a lot? Oh yeah, yeah. We catch like tons of them over here and they'll share it because they're interested in it, right? But they've known it for years, or we used to catch them like 30 years ago, but we don't see them anymore. You know, and so like you get the information from the fishers. So a lot of scientists rely on that information and they're like just local people. You know, Chesapeake Bay, for instance, like you will go in and you'll talk to people in the little villages that are around that bay and you'll say like, what's been happening here? Like, what are you noticing? I have a friend who lives out in St. Michael's, in like along the bay, and it's a little village right there. And he put in like a tide gauge because certain streets continue to get flooded every so often. Anytime there's a rain or, you know, anytime there's a big tide, those streets are shut down. And people are like, how do we stop this? And he's like, well, first we got to find out, you know, when it happens. And so he's a scientist, he's a tech guy, and he goes in and he does all the stuff and he brings it back to the village and says, yeah, this is what's happening. It's not, he doesn't say this is climate change, we need to stop this, you know, it's a political thing. It's not, this is just how the water's acting and it's how it's affecting our streets. So if you don't want this to flood every once in a while, this is, you know, these are our options. Let's bring in some engineers. Let's do this. And like maybe we need to raise a road a little bit to adapt to it and stuff like that. And I think that's what we really need to go with, you know, when we talk about conservation is, you know, we need to have an understanding of everybody's perspective and stop this bickering and stop this dividing for whatever reason and just be like, look, like things are changing. We know things are changing. Like we could stop it. You know, if there's enough will there, but we also have to adapt to it. And we're all in the same, literally in the same boat, you know? And so it's really up to us to kind of work together to do this. And I feel like if we stop judging, you know, everybody's perspective and just start embracing the perspective and understanding how you want to deal with it, then we can really tackle a lot of these problems together and be able to, you know, go out and solve or adapt to these problems until they're solved later down the road.
Yeah. So listening to a few of your more recent podcasts about the few that I had the time to listen to. And they were really good. I really enjoyed
them. Thank you. I appreciate that.
It seems like a lot of talk about the renewed drilling efforts in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
So I this is a tough one, right? I mean, look, mm-hmm. we're not getting off oil, not anytime soon. It's not possible, right? I think
totally agree.
Inroads, et cetera. So,
yep.
Are there any? My hope would be there are some marine biologists out there working with some of these geologists, which I think most of them are, to come up with ways to better contain, better secure these things because we know they're going to do them. One of the other things I was wondering, because this is something that I have actually enjoyed quite a lot. If you've never been diving off of an oil rig. My goodness.
So much stuff. I mean, so much stuff.
Yeah. Everything from nudibranchs to pelagic life. Yeah. You've got sharks. You've got whales, dolphins. Oh, yeah. You name it.
Mahi,
right?
Mahi. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Tuna. The amount of life that clusters around these structures.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any efforts to maybe increase some of the structure size, add more surface area, give more life to this area that, you know, you're adding a risk, maybe add a benefit that can kind of counter some of that risk?
So, yeah, when it comes to, say, like oil platforms, let's take the Gulf of Mexico, for instance, because, you know, there are a lot of oil platforms there, and there's been a lot of research done on sort of the aggregation of animals and habitats along oil rigs or below the surface, right, of the sea along oil rigs. Because it's kind of interesting when you look at underwater, you know, animals, like it is not a benefit to be in a water column without anything around it. You know, sharks do it, whales do it because they're traveling all the time. But where they stop to eat or where they stop to spawn or where they stop for nursery site has to have food and it has to have a hiding spot. So hiding out in sort of the ocean column, like the water column, is a very difficult thing to do. So anytime you put a structure into the ocean, you will get somebody or something to actually attach onto it because it's to their benefit. It's that structure. It could be a pile of rocks, right? That's limestone base, which is how reefs kind of form, or it could be a steel oil platform, right? And there are advantages and disadvantages to each. And coral reefs will attach themselves on to oil rigs just as much as they'll attach themselves on to like rocks, like a pile of rocks and have a habitat. The one thing with the structure of the oil rigs is, well, actually there's a couple of things. One, the metal that it's composed of will leach out, you know. So locally, it's not going to affect the entire ocean, but locally it could affect some of those animals that are benefiting off of being attached on or feeding off animals that are attached on to those poles or that are, you know, taking in some of those metals. And as those go through the food web, they could bioaccumulate into, bigger fish. And then eventually, like if we consume them, they could have high lead or arsenic or things like that. Now, we are very fortunate here in North America that our government tests for different types of metals and different types of toxins within our fish. And they will be able to, if they catch it in time, of course, they will be able to say, stay away from this type of fish if you're going to eat it, or mussels or things like that. And sometimes that has to do with metals because of an oil platform or a ship, but also it could also have to do with just, you know, red tide. You know, you just never know when you're going to get a red tide, right? So there's a lot of, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages to have it, but there are habitats and we need more habitats. And so, you know, I don't know if it's a benefit to, like, I know we've seen people, especially for diving communities, sink ships, like old ships, to like create this type of diving tourism act, or even a bit try to encourage more accumulation of animals in habitats like coral reefs and sponges and this and that. I don't know if I would say that we should be putting in more of this kind of stuff, but definitely taking advantage of things that are already in there. Right. So like oil platforms that are there, they're very difficult to remove. I don't even know if they figured out if they could remove them or not. I'm not too sure how that works, but they're huge. Like these are huge platforms, like,
oh, yeah,
really big. It'd be a process, and you might damage the ocean more by taking them out than putting them in. Now, the other thing is we have these wells. Right. And one of the recent interviews I did with a gentleman out of Louisiana, where he talked about how, and here's the problem with the industry. Yes, you're right. We rely on oil. We are an oil-based society for energy, just like we used to rely on whale blubber for oil. Now we rely on oil and gas. It wasn't good then when we did it, but we needed it. And, you know, oil, we figured out now it's probably not the best thing for our planet, you know, long term, and it's a finite resource. So eventually we're going to have to move off from it, or at least diversify, you know, our dependence on oil. But here's the problem when we look at any type of industry. You can come in and do the industry. You will benefit the local community for that time being. But in the long run, are you benefiting the community for future generations? Right? The damage that the oil and gas industry has done in a state like Louisiana, especially southern Louisiana, in so many different facets, almost, and then you look at like, does it outweigh the benefits that it provided it for however many years, right? And will it do that in the future? And here's the problem. It's not necessarily the oil companies. I mean, it's partly that. But it's also the people in charge of making sure that they do as little damage as possible. Right. And we know spills happen, right? They can't do big spills. BP spill, the Deepwater Horizon spill happened because of mismanagement. The government didn't regulate enough, and the people, the company didn't make sure that they were safer. And 11 people lost their lives because of it, right? Like, from we look at everything else that happened, 11 people lost their life because of this dangerous endeavor. You know, like getting oil from the deep sea is a very dangerous thing that we have a better understanding now, but we still don't have a good understanding in terms of how to cap it and clean it up. Like the Deepwater Horizon, they had to go to James Cameron to get advice on how to cap it because he was the only one at the time who had the most experience doing deep water dives,
right?
Because of the movie he did on the Titanic, which is, if you think about that, that's crazy because of all the engineers that the US has and that the world has, you would think that they'd be able to figure out faster to cap something like this. And so I think the problem is, like, even the old wells that they've had is they don't clean it up or they don't maintain it to the best of their ability. And I think that's the problem because, like, when you come into a community and you promise the world to this community, we'll give you jobs, we'll give you money, we'll give you everything you need. But when we leave, we're going to forget you, you know, and we're not going to come back and clean it up. And that's on the government for not holding them to it as well. Like, and I think that's where, like, a lot of people, like a lot of the stuff that I'm doing around this, because this new oil and gas plan that the US released is basically opening up, I think it's like 1.4 billion acres of ocean to lease. Now, will all that get drilled? Probably not.
Not a chance.
You know, but, you know, there's some areas that might get that will definitely get drilled in 30 years. Not now. It's going to happen in 30 years. And that's going to maintain. And like we said before, like, oil will always be in our lives as long as it's available. Is that at what percentage of the energy factor will it be? Like, will eventually renewables, whether we like it or not, are going to take over because we're figuring out better technology and we're able to capture more. We're able to use it. Now it's just a matter of, can we store it? I mean, that's the big thing about renewables is, can we have the batteries? And we're getting there. And we're getting better batteries that don't require these precious metals that we're looking for deep sea mining and so forth. So I think with any industry, it's like, how do you treat the local community? Not just the environment, right? Because we need to protect people first. Can you guarantee that you will take care of that community for not only as long as you're there and using the resources, but even after that, to make sure that nobody dies, from poisoning or bad water quality. Like Louisiana is a state that, especially southern Louisiana, that lives off the land. You know, they will get crabs, they will get shrimp, they will get fish, you know, they will get anything that they can get out because they love the land, they love the water. And so to destroy that for them because of one single industry is a real shame, and it's not doing them justice. And so I think a lot of the stuff that I've come to realize as I do these interviews is, are we protecting the people in this situation? Yes, we need oil. We need to lower dependence. Like I'm Canadian. We have a lot of oil. We don't even use it ourselves. You know, we're trying to export it
Don't say that too loud.
I know. Hey, like we give it to the U.S. Until recently, we would give it to the U.S. And so we're actually now, because of what's happening around the world, we're actually looking at where else can we do it. So we're building more pipelines. We're building all this stuff. So we're putting our people and indigenous people, because that's where the lands, that's where this pipelines are going to go through, and our environment at risk even more, because we're trying to diversify who buys our oil. Now, with that said, we also have a huge landscape. We're the second largest country with the longest coastline in the world, and we have a massive capacity, and we're already using a lot of that capacity to do renewables and to live off the land where we are treating it properly, and we can actually treat people properly. Is it perfect? Absolutely not, but it's better than what we realize the alternative.
Progress is always better than perfection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think with that said, with progress, are some of these industries, whether renewable or non-renewable or fossil fuels, are they actually working to make better progress to change our environment? I don't trust that they are.
No,
they aren't. The reason I don't trust that they are is because they've lied for so damn long, you know, and to us, and then they even admit it. And then they say, you know what? Now that climate change is so bad, this is what they're saying now. You can't do anything about it. So we might as well just embrace the oil and gas. Like that's how brazen they are to do that. And I think that's why I do these episodes on it's to kind of show how people have lived. Like one of the episodes I did is just how people are living in southern Louisiana now, and after the oil companies have left, because a lot of them have left, not all, but a lot of them have left. And wells are leaking, their land and resources are polluted, and the people have to take care of that. And a lot of the people can't just get up and move, right? They can't sell their homes because nobody's going to buy them. You know, the land is cut up because they do these cutaways with these ships, so much so that you have grave sites that are being exposed, whether they're indigenous or non-indigenous. I mean, that's a cultural thing. Anybody should deserve that culture and that rest and make sure their ancestors are at rest. So it's like there's a lot of different things that go around it, even more than the environment. And that's something that I've come to realize by doing these interviews and looking at this particular, plan. And it's not just because it's the U.S. It's not just because it's Trump. Canada's been doing this for a long time. And it's like we can't just go in without understanding the ocean and what we're doing to it and what the consequences are for doing to it. And a lot of the time it's the local people that suffer from it, right?
Oh yeah. I would argue pretty much always. We see a lot of the same, you see a lot of the same on land as well, right? We were talking about the big commercial fishing, right? That goes on, right? Well, we also have all around us right now is big commercial farming.
Now,
if you just go and look, Joel Salatin has shown this. A number of people have shown this. I can't remember the gentleman's name. He actually did a session with Mr. Rogan. But he was showing the stark difference. Like, here's my property line, and on the other side is conventional ag, and it's dead. And I could do the same. You can go to the edge of my property line and look at the ag field. It's dead. The soil is gray, lifeless, gone.
Yeah.
And then you look at ours and it's a completely different story, right?
Yeah.
And so those unintended consequences also affect people like the hunters in North Carolina, where the deer, right? These areas that were big deer plots, that were forested areas, are now ag plots. They can't, they won't usually, they still do, but they, I guess, less so, right? Instead of a food plot for deer, they'll have soybean or corn or something. The deer will eat some of that, but it's not their preferred food. Right. And a lot of that is pesticides, herbicides, as well as, you know, and we could argue the merits or, you know, otherwise of GMO, but I'm not a fan.
I get it.
Understand the need in sub-Saharan Africa and places like this, but locally there is not. And so what you get is hunters with a lower deer population, and these people literally go out and hunt, and the meat that they put up is for their year's meat. They don't buy meat at a store. And now they're finding themselves in a conundrum where they're having to buy meat at the store. Right. So, you know, anytime you get into this big industry, I feel you start to experience this sort of stuff. And, you know, honestly, I think, to be honest with you, and this is going to sound counter, but I honestly think the government is more responsible for that than they are responsible for fixing it. A lot of the laws and regulations are written to protect these big industries. They make it way more difficult for the small folks, like the small fisheries, the small fishermen. And, you know, the big guys get breaks and incentives and, you know, basically, you know, carte blanche access and, you know, everything they want. And they don't care. They just want to make money. So
that's it. I read a book, a number of years ago, probably over a decade ago, where it was like different sort of like green type stories and how the environment has changed over the years. And one of the stories, of course, was Monsanto. Monsanto. Thank you. Sorry. I forgot the name for a sec. Monsanto and how they were able to lobby the government to get them as a corporation the same rights as a regular human.
Yeah.
And so that anything that would happen against them was like, well, that's our human right. That's our right as a company to be able to do this. And I think the famous thing with Monsanto was the fact that they had these GMO seeds. They were selling them to certain farmers. And of course, with seeds, as you know, as a farmer, wind will take the seeds and it'll blow onto a different property. And so they would go on that property and say, you have our seeds, you owe us money, pay up or we'll sue. And they're like, it's our right because we own that seed and we have the same rights as you do. And I think, you know, when you talk about government, I think allowing that to happen has changed the way we look at big business right now. And especially when we look at, you know, natural resource, whether it be, you know, agriculture, whether it be aquaculture, whether it be fishing, whether it be oil and gas or renewables, it's just changed the game. There are people and companies within the renewables game who are awful, you know, and treating the environment like crap because they just want to make money. There are a lot of greedy people on both sides of these things. The key for us, I feel like, as a human puppet, is the diversity of types of industries, the diversity of the different types of ways to do things. I think that is the best way. And it really comes down to looking at nature. Diversity is the one that's the most stable. So why are we allowing all these monopolies to happen? So, you know, it's the same thing. We're never going to allow, like, we don't want, when we look at fish stocks, we don't want a fish stock that only has like two different species. We want a fish stock that has like, you know, 10 to 12 in a specific area or more, you know, because that changes things and we don't want things to change. We want things to stabilize. It's best for us. It's best for our planet. And there are ways to do it. There are people who are actually out there working to do that. It's just hard sometimes to inspire people to do everything because a lot of it is not like the sexy kind. You know what I mean? Like it's fun to watch somebody tag a shark. Like it's fun, you know, you get, especially like ocean arch, they were really cool because, you know, they get these massive great whites, you know, they have this huge contraption that like brings them on and they get on top and they like, you know, they put the tag on, they take, you know, data, they make a huge profile for like Lydia or when they give it a name and stuff. And then they track this shark wherever it goes until as long as the satellite tag is on. And they've been able to uncover a huge like conservation success story through for great whites and their expansion and growth as a population, not only on the East Coast, but on the West Coast and in other places around the world. And that's sexy. That's fun to watch. Like there's Shark Week shows on it and everything is good. But trying to get people to get inspired by biodiversity is not so sexy, right? Because it's more of a policy thing. Other than like going underneath the water and getting videographers to take beautiful pictures and video of like, you know, huge fish schooling fish and everything, bait balls and whales. And but you don't always get that. And that's hard to get. Yeah. That's expensive to get. And we don't have a lot of money to do that all the time. And so it's a difficult thing to inspire people to do, is especially with for protecting marine biodiversity.
Yeah. And, you know, interest, I'm going to parallel this back to the farm, right?
Of course.
So we, you know, we have a house, we don't live on the dirt, you know, and,
right.
You know, we have a backyard that the house dogs are, it's a fenced in yard that they
okay.
live in. And then we have our pasture space for our animals, and we have our fowl area,
you know,
gardens, et cetera. We don't have a lawn. I mean, we do, the diversity in the lawn is its strength.
So absolutely.
We've got weeds. We've got so many different kinds of annoying grass, good grass. I don't know. It's just a mess. When it's mowed, it looks great. But here's the benefit is we don't pump anything onto it. And it stays green, it stays lush, and it stays wonderful. We don't do anything to it. We don't put fertilizer, we don't put pre-emergent, we don't put, you know, any of this stuff on there. But that diversity is what allows it to maintain itself even under attack from, like, we had a really bad case of army worms come in. Was it year before last? And I don't know if you know what these things are, but they'll go through and just eat like all of the grass, and just, they're like locusts, but they're little worms. And somehow our space remained largely untouched, and we had thousands of these things in there. So there must have been species they didn't like. But the same thing in the ocean, right? If you have something that impacts one species, you know, that biodiversity means that life still exists, which keeps that food chain intact, which keeps the reefs getting cleaned. It keeps that turnover going that's necessary for a healthy reef, for a healthy, you know, fish habitat, for pelagic life, for everything, right? And
absolutely.
So, you know, it's interesting you said that, because I think it applies everywhere.
100%. I mean, it's how life is lived. You know what I mean? Like the more diverse you have, the more stable your economy is, your habitats are, your lawn is, you know. I think we've just been not programmed, but influenced to, you know, your lawn has to look a certain way. I grew up, my dad loved his lawn. You know, if a weed got in there, God damn that weed, like you got to pull it out and you got to have like a perfect lawn. Everything has to be the perfect height and, you know, doing that. And now I look at my lawn and I'm like, yeah, I got some crabgrass. It sucks because it doesn't look as nice. But then you're like, kind of like, well, that's actually not that bad, you know. But you're always fighting those sort of like generational influences, you know. And you're like, okay, how do I maintain what, you know, my parents had, or how do I do this, or whether it's right or wrong. And then of course, you know, you have other people who look at it differently. You know, if I grew out my lawn, I live in a neighborhood. If I grew out my lawn where, you know, I have these shrubs and things that's kind of growing kind of out of control in a way, but naturally, oh, I'd get complaints. You know, somebody would probably call the city to come and, you know, give me a ticket, and they would mow and they would give me, you know, the money to do that ticket. I can do it in my backyard, but maybe not in my front yard. And so there's a lot to fight against when it comes to that. But when people really understand it, and I think people get it when it comes to the ocean because it looks good. You know, like when you have a documentary or a really good, you know, videographer go underwater and take those things, or you scuba dive, you know, and you're looking at stuff, and there's nothing like seeing a reef with all these different corals. And you can see what I like to do. I don't know if you like to do this, Havoc, but like, you, obviously you see the fish and you see the wonders and it's always great. Maybe a couple of sharks here and there, a sea turtle or something like that. You're having a good dive. For me, I like to scale down a little bit, and I'm looking for those nematodes. I'm looking for those worms and those crabs. Yeah. And there's nothing like you get this, you're kind of coming up, you're ascending a little bit on the reef. You see this beautiful like coral or sponge that's opened up and it's got a big circle in the middle. And you look in, you kind of turn upside down a little bit. You look in and there's this like shrimp crab kind of guy who's like looking at you like, don't you come near me. And he's like, you know, moving all that. He's got this antenna all over the place and it's just absolutely gorgeous. That's beautiful. But you know, I always refer back to this where it's like, you know, there's a cartoon and it shows like, you know, these two guys who are shipwrecked on an island and it's this little island, like literally you can't even run around it without knocking into each other. And they're like, they look out, all they can see is the surface. And they look out, man, it's like, oh, I'm so hungry. I wish there was food somewhere. And then they have the cartoon underneath the sea. It's got everything, all these different types of fish, octopus, crabs, lobsters, shrimp. And they just look up on the surface and they're like, there's nothing here. Like, what are we going to do? How are we going to survive? And I think that's life. You know, there's a lot of people who don't know anything about the ocean. Yeah. Right. Or anything about the water, just as like there are people who don't know about land and like what Africa really looks like or what Asia really looks like. And, you know, what diversity really looks like. I can dive in the Caribbean and then I can go dive in Indonesia and I'm going to see a lot of different things you know, a lot more diversity, untouched kind of areas. And I think that's what it is. I think it's just more of like trying to get out of our own way and experience these things so that we understand how important these things are, and learning. And it really comes back down to the reason why I do the podcast is to provide a resource for people who want to know more about the ocean. And just the fact that they're learning about the ocean allows them to give them the knowledge to do something about it. Right. And almost like, and I hate to say this sometimes, it's a bit of a guilt. Once you know, it's really hard to like go back to the regular life and be like, yeah, I'm just going to be naive and ignorant, you know, and we do that about every subject matter, you know, yeah, but once you know, you're like, oh, okay, I got this. Like I'm going to do this. I'm going to help whichever way I can.
Yeah. It's a lot like the Matrix, right? Once you awaken to it, there's no real going back. You know,
it's like, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's awesome. So, you know, I want to give you a chance as well to kind of talk about, you know, your work, what you're working on now, where people can find you, you know,
absolutely,
how they can, you know, get, you know, hold of some of your work, etc. So let's hear it.
For sure. Well, you can go to speakupforblue.com. That's my website. So speakupforblue.com, all one word. And you'll see the two shows that are on there. There's the How to Protect the Ocean podcast and the Beyond Jaws podcast. You know, you can listen to both. You can listen to one. I put out on the How to Protect the Ocean podcast, I put out 3 episodes a week. So we've been doing this for a long time. We're almost like we're at about 1850 episodes, 1860 episodes. So, you know, we're getting there. We're almost at 2000 episodes, probably within the next year or so. And on the Beyond Jaws, we release, you know, every other week, you know, as we can. And sometimes we'll do a bonus episode and stuff. And there's always interesting nuggets that you can take from both of those shows. They're equally as great. What I'm trying to do is really build a network of podcasts that will provide people with the information that they need. You know, I'm working on crowdfunding a seagrass podcast because it's such an important habitat that doesn't get talked about a lot. And so what I always tell people is like, it's such a biodiversity hotspot. It's more biodiverse than most reefs. And so the fact that we keep them, they're not sexy like reefs. They're not beautiful colors. They're like green. And it can be, you know, people think, oh, it's just seaweed. It's not seaweed. They're a plant. And you know, you gotta look. But if you have ever gone diving havoc and you kind of part some of the seagrass around, you'll see like a pufferfish pop up or who knows, you know, whatever you might see, depending on where you are.
I used to love just dumping my BC, sitting cross-legged and watching it. Just
something
mesmerizing about the seagrass.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, as it comes over, like you were saying, not necessarily having to part it, but as it comes over and stands up before it folds over, you get like this kind of
running
look and you'll see so many things.
So many.
Amazing.
Yeah. And so like, I want people to know about that. And there's a lot of research. There's a lot of people around the world who are trying to protect and restore a lot of the seagrass areas. They're a huge blue carbon sink. So that means they take up carbon dioxide and they take up carbon and they put it down into the ocean, into the sediments for, you know, up to a millennia. And so they take it up more like 4 to 10 times more than a land tree. You know, so that's how important they are from a carbon sequestration point of view, a natural one, right? And one that works, that we know that works. And so, and they clean up water, they stabilize the sediment, they stabilize the habitats. And so what I'm trying to do with that podcast is bring, like, by interviewing researchers and conservationists that are out, that are working with seagrasses, I'm bringing that research together. So people in Europe can hang out with people and listen to what people in North America are doing, or what people in Asia are doing, or Australia, or wherever they might be in Africa. And they can share that knowledge and they can meet each other through there and understand what they're doing and maybe collaborate in the future. And then as people, because it's a crowdfunding campaign, as people donate, I'm going to use some of those funds, a portion of those funds, to give to an organization that's doing a restoration work. And we're going to follow that through the podcast to tell people the benefits and what's happening. You know, the ups and downs of funding a project like that. We'll probably be a minor funder, but it's something that I think people can get to see and track as they go. And then after a while, they can be like, yeah, like, I helped restore a seagrass meadow in like the south of France. Like, that's pretty cool. If you ever go there, you can be like, yeah, I helped do this. I gave, like, you know, $60, $100, $10, you know, whatever that might be. But I also brought researchers together to improve that communication, that transparency with research and maybe collaboration. So that's what I'm trying to do, working with organizations to get them on podcasts. I feel like podcasts is such a good way to communicate science, because people listen to the episodes a little longer, whether watching it on video or listening to it on audio. You know, most of my podcasts I listen to on audio when I walk my dog, so I can multitask at the same time or cook my dinner or make my food, is when I usually do it. And so there's the audio podcast, the video. We try and hit people all over the place so that they have no excuse not to listen to the podcast. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to build a podcast network that talks about the ocean, different aspects about the ocean, so everybody can have whatever they love, they can listen to. And on the other hand, I'm trying to help out, you know, organizations and people working in the field to get to sort of amplify their voices, to get their voices and projects out, so that people can know what they're doing. You know, like, just right now, you know, deep sea mining is a huge thing in the U.S. There's a lot of public comment periods that are out there. We're trying, you know, working with people who are from the Mariana Islands, where one of the sites is proposed, you know, getting the perspective of the people of the Mariana Islands. You know, they hold almost 80% of the U.S. oceans in a small island. And and they're trying to drill there, but it's going to affect them. So again, looking at local people and getting their perspective and what they want, what they don't want, making sure their voices get amplified to make sure that, you know, people understand what they're going through or what they're about to go through. So it's a lot of fun. Like, so if, check it out, speakupforblue.com. We're on your favorite podcast app, How to Protect the Ocean, Beyond Jaws. And again, like, just thank you guys for having me on. It's been such a fun conversation.
It really has. And we thank you for coming on. We really appreciate it. Okay. So two questions for you.
Number one, let's do it.
You mentioned a science teacher. Let's do a shout out if you don't mind, if you don't want to mention the person by name, but if you would like to, let's shout out your science teacher. I think that's super important.
Yeah. So so I had a high school science teacher, Mr. Spencer. I don't even know his first name. Isn't that awful? Because you just know, you know, back in the day, you just call him Mr. Spencer. He taught a course called Science and Society. And it was almost like you're going over environmental issues by doing experiments. So we had to do everything from engineering to looking at environmental issues to looking at how people work within society and how people use technology. And he was just, you know, he was a very monotone speaker, but he had this dry wit to him that he would, like, sarcastically cut you up, you know, but in a fun way. And he just made things a lot of fun. And I think it definitely drove me to go more towards conservation than just straight up science research. And so shout out to Mr. Spencer, wherever he is now, and the help that he got me to get really interested.
Awesome. All right. And then last one, shout out to anyone you want, anyone for any reason, just a shout out.
Well, I'm going to say my wife, because she puts up with a lot of me in my office doing all this work after I work my full-time job and, you know, be with the kids and the family and stuff. So shout out to my wife. She's awesome. She's supported me in everything that I do. It takes up a lot of time and a lot of effort. And she's given me some great advice over the years. So I'm going to say shout out to my wife, Mandy.
That is awesome. Well, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate you coming on. Hey, everybody, you know where you can find us, just about everywhere. You can also engage with us if you'd like to. You can go to Telegram on t.me/spacetomatoes. You can go in there. We upload the episodes. We'll upload content from episodes. And we're available to chat. If you have ideas for a show, ideas for a guest, let us know. Give us a like, share, follow, comment, do the thing, have fun. And remember, wherever you are, whenever you're listening to this, have an amazing day.
See ya.